Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:47, and that is Pacific Summer Time, and today is July 1st, and of course today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. But if we have a review of what's been happening this week, then it really is the precious metals have stolen the game here. And I think, wouldn't it be appropriate, just against the background of where monetary policy appears to be heading, that if we start to look at the precious metal markets and frame other asset classes in terms of gold, silver, platinum, and maybe even palladium, in those terms, rather than looking at gold in terms of other markets, which is what we are so often tempted to do. The biggest argument that fundamental investors have always used against gold is that it doesn't pay a yield, therefore it can't be valued on a dividend discount model. And that's a very one-dimensional way of looking at asset classes, for the simple reason that there is a very clear difference between stocks and bonds, which are entirely man-made, and commodities, which are resources that have to be extracted. And they cannot simply be valued on the same basis. But it isn't to say that they don't have value, and they have particular value when the man-made assets, which we attach such great value to, are then the way in which that they are valued is called into question. And that is indeed what is happening right now. Because it is no exaggeration to say that that everything is priced off the 10-year bond yield. And the 10-year bond yield is extraordinarily low. And for more than half the sovereign bonds in the world, it's negative. And UK gilts are now at about 80 basis points. I think it's actually more like 84 basis points. And certainly they were a bit lower in the middle of the week, and they have pulled back a little bit. But when we consider what is it that the Bank of England is most likely to do, then how likely is it that they are going to raise interest rates? Extraordinarily unlikely. Are they going to go down the same path that both the Bank of Japan and the ECB have adopted, which was to implement negative interest rates? Well, that is open to question. But then what is an alternative? That they could engage in additional quantitative easing. The Bank of England has engaged in quantitative easing previously. It has maintained the size of its balance sheet almost exactly unchanged since then, and might easily re-engage with quantitative easing. And not least, that would put additional downward pressure on the pound. If government bond yields are at such incredibly low levels, and I'm going to post a very interesting chart that a subscriber kindly forwarded in here today of the German Bund yield over the last over 100 years. And it has only been this low once before, and that was in the 1920s. And immediately after that, you had yields spiking higher. And of course, that was in response to hyperinflation that took hold in Germany at the time. Now, we don't have any evidence of hyperinflation just yet, and indeed we may not get it. But what is very real is that if you're going to price assets off of the bond yield, well, then everything looks cheap, because it doesn't matter what the valuation is. If what you're pricing it off of is negative, then what choice do you have? And that's particularly poignant, or it's a particular quandary for yield-hungry investors, because how on earth could they justify buying bonds that they are absolutely guaranteed to lose money on? Because by and large, yield investors are buy and hold, and then that means that they value their assets on a yield-to-maturity basis. And on a yield-to-maturity basis, half the sovereign bonds in the world yield less than zero. And who's to say that that number isn't going to increase? That, you know, 6 months from now, perhaps it will be 60% of bonds have negative yields, or perhaps even more than that. So we are at a rather extraordinary situation, and therefore perhaps we should, instead of pricing things off of the bond yield, price them relative to gold. And gold prices are were up $20 today. They're at $1,343. It's not that long ago. They were around $1,200. And silver today was up almost $1.20. It very briefly tested the $20 area and closed very marginally off of that peak. But when we look at those assets, then as a benchmark, they're doing rather well in an environment where the value of money is being put under great pressure by simple virtue of the fact that central banks are about to start printing it as if it was going out of fashion. And in many respects, it is going out of fashion. There doesn't seem to be any consideration at all that one can issue bonds with absolutely no regard for ever paying the money back. And that would sound to me like the greatest contradiction, perhaps, in the history of financial markets, that you can borrow money with absolutely no regard for ever paying it back, and that every government everywhere can do that for as long as they want and never have to worry about paying the money back. If that doesn't sound like the greatest contradiction you've ever heard, and if someone else can make sense of that, then I would really be intrigued for someone to make sense of that. Because when we can identify what the contradiction is in any major bull market, and this is an incredibly large bull market, that bond yields have been compressing for over 30 years. And in fact, we're in 2016, so it's more like 36 years. And I'm 39 years old, so in fact, I can't ever remember a time when bond yields were not compressing. And I remember as a child, my grandmother buying Irish government bonds and rolling them over for us. Then they created quite a little nest egg because of that accumulating interest by the time we went to college. And my youngest brother, who is 20 years my junior, did not benefit from that because yields had come down so much already. And today, if you're a saver, you have absolutely no recourse to that kind of potential for compound interest in the bond market. But you perhaps do have it in the equity markets. And then when we look at equities, what is it that we know for sure? And it is that and equities are responding in perhaps much the same way that gold is, that their supply is reasonably inelastic, in that we haven't had a swathe of additional issuance. In fact, we've had rather the opposite, that companies have been buying back their shares in increasing numbers, and not particularly for not because prices are so very low, but because the cost of borrowing the money to buy back the shares is so incredibly low. And generally speaking, from a corporate finance perspective, bonds are cheaper to issue than equity, and often by a considerable margin. So companies have been buying back their shares. The net effect of that is that, despite the fact that we've had some very large IPOs, and you know, Facebook being a very good example, but at the same time, the quantity of shares that have been bought back is in the order of trillions of dollars in the last 6 or 7 years. So while it isn't correct to say that that the supply of shares is inelastic, because it can be, they can be printed into existence, money can be borrowed, or they can be sold, and new shares made out of virtually nothing, but that is not what has been going on. So that is perhaps one of the reasons, perhaps the easiest explanation for why stock prices have been going up for so long. It isn't because, and particularly over the last 2 and 3 years, it isn't because corporate profits have been surging higher. In fact, corporate profits have been deteriorating. But the assets, the money that can be used to purchase stocks, has been inflating. And if the supply of that money is inflating, then asset prices goes up and go up, and then that suggests that we have a liquidity fueled rally in stocks, we have a liquidity fueled rally in precious metals, and we have a liquidity fueled rally in bond prices. But we don't have a liquidity fueled rally in wages. We don't have a liquidity fueled rally in employment. What we have is wages that are struggling to move higher, employment that is back at capacity, but it's taken 7 years to get there in the US, and we are a very long way from that in continental Europe. So then if we're moving into a period of synchronized global monetary expansion, 10 years ago we used to talk about synchronized global economic expansion, but I think it's perhaps more appropriate these days to talk about global monetary expansion, then that could potentially be really quite bullish for equity prices. And then when we look at what exactly are we presented with in terms of the price charts, the FTSE 100 has been ranging mostly below 7,000 for 16 years. And if a range is an explosion waiting to happen, it's been waiting rather a long time. But when it eventually occurs, it's likely to take the majority of spectators by surprise. Now, of course, with the fact that the pound has fallen from $1.70 about 2 years ago to $1.32 2/3 at the time of recording, means that if the FTSE does indeed break out on the upside, it'll be doing it, shall we say, in nominal terms rather than in absolute terms. And of course, that would be dependent on the pound continuing to move lower. But then we look at the S&P 500, and it has been going sideways for almost 2 years. And in much the same way, a range is an explosion waiting to happen, because markets are either trending or ranging, and it means that every range is eventually resolved by a successful breakout. And at the upper side of the range, the S&P is currently at 2102. And then the high is around 2138, if my memory is correct. So we're really not very far at all from the all-time highs. And in fact, the market has staged an incredibly impressive bounce over the last three or four sessions to unwind the entire decline that we saw following Brexit. So then this is a rather interesting eventuality, because if you were to look at the weekly chart, then you really couldn't tell at all that something really important has happened to the Wall Street indices, but rather that the S&P has bounced rather emphatically from the region of its 200-day moving average. And I think it only spent just a couple of days below it. So this has been really rather orderly consolidation in the region, and mostly above the 200-day MA, and that's the upper side of nearly a two-year range. So then we could see the market breaking on the upside. And considering that this is a relatively lengthy, well-defined range, then the ferocity of a breakout could be really quite surprising to the vast majority of people, because they have been conditioned by a market which has been largely range-bound and subject to very traumatic, steep, swift pullbacks. Now, then if we look at where are we in terms of the psychological perception stages of major bull and bear markets, well, I think it's pretty easy to say that back in 2008, nobody believed that we would be at levels today that we really are at. So that was the disbelief phase. And then from about 2012 to 2015, we had acceptance. People got the message. And what was the message? The message was that as long as central banks are printing, stock prices are going to go up in a relatively orderly manner. And there is no point in in agonizing about the bull case or the bear case, but rather just ride on the coattails of a central bank and you'll be okay. So that was the acceptance phase. And then the question is, are we potentially now entering the third psychological perception stage, which is that the holdouts, the people who've been in cash all this time, then they just throw in the towel and they say, you know what, there is no point any longer looking at valuations, that the cyclically adjusted PE or the Shiller PE has been at historically high levels for the last few years, and now we're at all-time highs and it is going even higher. And there's no evidence that it is working on this occasion, and that we should really just borrow money at negative yields and then invest it in stocks. It's the only way to get a return for in this market. So we need to get long. And this is going to last forever. We might not like it. We might not like central banks. We might not like the way that that equities are moving. We might not like the expense of the buyback programs. But the market's going up, and if I want to make money, I'm going to have to get in on it. And that's just one potential outcome, or a potential rationalization for supporting a big breakout. And then, because there's a lot of people have been in cash, then there's a lot of people who really you don't like the way that that money is being debauched, then they will have to get the new religion. And the new religion is that it doesn't matter. And of course, we know that that's a contradiction in terms. We know that it will eventually all end in tears. But it may not end in tears right away. And it most particularly is unlikely to end in tears right after the breakout. But that it will probably go on for longer and last longer and go up more than many people anticipate. And of course, that is assuming that it happens at all. But if we do enter the third psychological perception stage, then it really would represent a mania. You could anticipate that people's and way of acting would be divorced quite considerably from reality, and then we would be into a bubble phase. And you know, when we look back at history, then the Fed is a serial bubble blower, and they will not act to curtail speculation until they absolutely have to. And and not least because they're political animals, and the one thing we can rely on bureaucrats to do is to ensure that they maintain their positions. So that is one of the reasons too that Europe has such problems, that the problems that it does, because it's ruled by a faceless bureaucracy whose primary interest is in sustaining its own importance. Then in that environment, gold can go up. It can continue to go higher. And there is no doubt right now that silver is a little bit overbought. Going up a dollar 24 in a day is plenty. And certainly something that both David and I have experienced over the last decades is that when silver rallies by more than a dollar in a day, that's usually a sign that it is going up rather quickly. So it wouldn't be at all surprising to see at least some consolidation in the region of that psychological $20 area. But it's probably likely to be only a consolidation. I must say I'm rather bashful that I sold half my silver position quite a bit below where prices are now. And also half the gold position, but I guess gratified that I held on to both my platinum and palladium, even though they were rolled forward at a loss. I guess neither, they both recouped that and more since. And then when we start to look around, then because we could potentially be moving into a period of global economic, or economic going sideways, but monetary expansion, then then we know what quantitative easing does. It creates this environment where you get asset price inflation, and then the kinds of companies that generate a yield, those that have got a long history of increasing their dividends, then the yield on some of those shares is going to go and approach very low levels, because the supply of income that they offer is really going to be very, very attractive indeed. And when, for example, you can look at a share like Coca-Cola, which is a yield of 3% and an estimated PE of 23, and that really offers the yield hungry or value investor a dilemma, because they wouldn't in their wildest imagination ever envisage having to pay 23 times earnings for a 3% yield, and yet that is exactly what they'll probably end up having to do. And then would they have to pay a PE of perhaps 35 for a 2% yield, or a PE of 50 for a half of a percent yield? Then, you know, this is the kind of environment that we could potentially moving into, where we do get valuations move from what are, you know, somewhat expensive levels to downright expensive levels, or just we move into a bubbly kind of scenario. And some of the companies that do indeed have these kinds of yields, that is likely to represent, some of the cases where they will benefit most. And from the perspective of the autonomies, well, certainly a lot of the autonomies have these long histories of increasing dividends, but they also have global reach. So, for example, a lot of the UK-listed corporate autonomies, they were relatively unaffected by the devaluation of the pound, and in fact have subsequently moved on to new all-time highs. And then they offer both defensive and growth characteristics, because they're so heavily influenced by what happens on a global basis rather than an individual country basis, and they're well supported by these strong balance sheets. And the deep contradiction, and it really is something that we just have to keep front and center, regardless of the fact that stocks are likely to benefit enormously from it. It is that you cannot simply issue bonds without ever worrying about having to pay back the principal. When we had the credit default swap boom, it was everybody can hedge their default risk. But of course, we know that somebody has to bear the default risk. In the tech boom, it was earnings don't matter because the growth is going to be so spectacular later. But of course, earnings very much do matter. So we are in a different paradigm. That history never repeats itself, but it certainly rhymes. We know exactly what the problem is likely to be. And in fact, we probably know when it's likely to be a problem, because a great deal of the debt that has been taken out after the credit crisis begins to mature from about 2018 onwards. So that's when the really big questions are going to be asked. Can that debt be refinanced at even more attractive levels? And the way yields are right now, that could potentially be possible. And that would push out the problem even further. And then, but the problem is that when we eventually do come to the end of this, what is just an extraordinary phase, and extraordinary is such a an overused word in today's environment, but we should really just break it down into its constituent parts. We have extra, and we have ordinary. So we have extraordinary, or ordinary times two, and perhaps even ordinary times three, because that is the kind of stimulus that the market has become largely inured to. Then if we do get an acceleration of stimulus on a global basis, then that is likely to have a heavily inflationary effect on both stocks, bonds, precious metals, and property. And property has largely recovered in much of the U.S. And on the way to Las Vegas, I was just on Thursday, I was, on Wednesday, I was sitting next to a guy who worked for a property fund on the plane, and he was saying that, he was going to Las Vegas because they own a hotel there. And he was saying that commercial property has slowed down a lot in the primary hubs and is still going very strong indeed in the second tier cities in the USA. And that certainly gels with what we've seen from the Wall Street Journal and other publications, that the commercial property market has slowed down somewhat. But I wonder, is it going to pick up again if we move into an environment where the cost of borrowing goes down even further? And if the cost of borrowing money goes down, well, then the asset price goes up. Then it's quite likely that it isn't just stocks and bonds, but also property could benefit from the kind of environment that we're currently getting. And of course, it isn't just the precious metals. It could also be the commodities more generally. And we are presented in the oil price with one of the most consistent advances anywhere, where we've had five reactions in the region of about $6 since January. So, I mean, and when you get a consistent chart like that, it becomes really very easy to analyze, because a reaction of greater than $6, a break in the progression of higher reaction lows, would be required to question it. And then when that eventually does happen, we'll have very clear evidence that it is over, and that this impressive rally, which has seen prices almost double from their lows, will be over. And then that will put some downward pressure, not just on oil, but also on stock markets and potentially on commodity prices generally. But if we are moving into a period of monetary expansion, then oil prices might stay a bit higher than one might have originally anticipated, simply because they're responding to the inflating the inflation of the monetary base. But if we look medium term, there isn't any real good reason why oil prices should stay high. Rather, that technology is improving at such a remarkably quick rate, and is perhaps also the monetary expansion contributes to that, because the ability of companies to source the capital necessary to build their businesses has seldom been as easy as it is now. And part of the reason for that is because interest rates are very low. And nonetheless, the pace of technological innovation is unlikely to stop. And that's particularly the case in healthcare and in energy, where solar cells are getting progressively cheaper. Not necessarily progressively more efficient in the kind of exponential way that we might like, but they are getting progressively cheaper. Battery technology is getting progressively more efficient and cheaper. And then when you marry those two things together, you can have an environment where energy prices become much less of a problem. And despite the fact that we have this political upheaval and the rise of populism, particularly in Europe and in the USA, isn't it interesting that the reform-minded governments in Asia are gaining in power, and that even in the Philippines, where Rodrigo Duterte is someone who is as brash and loudmouthed as Donald Trump, he has an economic policy that is remarkably similar to his predecessor, that he is going to try and deliver economic policy cohesion and stability, even as he tries to fight corruption and create a federal state that would hopefully reduce the unrest in a number of the outlying islands. Then Indonesia, where Widodo is consolidating power, and is probably in a better position now than he was when he originally won the election. And then India is something that we really do have to watch after Mr. Rajan has decided that he doesn't want another term as governor of the RBI. But these are countries that have large populations, and they're doing the kinds of things necessary to bring their masses of young people into a position where they can aspire to, truly aspire, with the possibility of achieving a middle-class lifestyle. And that becomes a lot easier for these types of countries when energy prices are low and the availability of technology. And not only that it is improving, but that it is going to be available to these countries means that they should continue to be able to benefit, even in an environment where populism is on the rise just about everywhere else. And if we kind of play it forward and think about the possibility that that populist governments take power not just in one country but in a number of countries in Europe and the USA, then perhaps the greatest risk to markets from that isn't so much that they're suddenly going to turn into monetary purists, usually it's exactly the opposite, but rather that the threat of antitrust against some of the very large companies would become something that would have to be priced into their share prices, and that could potentially represent a medium term or even a potentially longer term threat, but it's certainly not something that's that we need to worry about in the very short term. And I think with that I will leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.